I'm Aaron Rothstein of the Ethics and Public Policy Center's Bioethics and American Democracy Program. Welcome to Searching for Medicine's Soul. Today's guest is Dr. Mark David Monk. He received his BA in Liberal Arts from Colgate University, a Master of Public Health in Epidemiology from Boston University, and a medical degree from Philadelphia's Jefferson Medical College. He completed a residency in emergency medicine and a fellowship in global health at the University of Pittsburgh, and later earned a diploma in tropical medicine and hygiene. In 2012, he earned a Master's of Science degree in healthcare management from the Harvard School of Public Health. Over the past decade, he has held senior leadership roles at various healthcare delivery organizations in the United States and abroad. He is the recent author of Urgent Calls from Distant Places, an emergency doctor's notes about life and death on the frontiers of East Africa. Mark, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your path to medicine and specifically to emergency medicine.
Yeah, it's one of those accidental things, honestly, Aaron. As you say, I mean, I graduated college with a degree in philosophy and religion, so with no pre-medical preparation at all. So, you know, in retrospect, it was kind of shocking I ended up in medicine, but I ended up in medicine really virtue of good luck. I ended up volunteering for the town's volunteer ambulance service when I was first a freshman in college. Nothing I would have ever imagined doing, but it seemed sort of interesting. There was a pamphlet that was sent out to incoming students. And so I joined, and really for 4 years, I spent most of my time in the ambulance barn, training at the community college at night to become an EMT and an advanced EMT. And that really directed me on the path towards medicine. I had to go back, do all the pre-medical sciences, and then finally ended up in medical school. And I think once I was there, it felt that emergency medicine would continue to be an interest and a passion of mine. And that's how I ended up really in emergency medicine with a real focus on EMS for much of my career.
You indicate or hint at some of the things that you did after you graduated from fellowship that seemed pretty interesting. Can you tell us a bit about what you did when you graduated from training?
Yeah. So I've always been a bit of a traveler. I've had a sort of a wanderlust, right? A little bit of a bug to go abroad. I decided after I graduated to take a job with the university who had a contract in the Middle East with Qatar, Middle Eastern, oil-rich country that was really trying to develop its clinical infrastructure. So I joined as the first medical director for the National Ambulance Service in the country of Qatar and had my foot in clinical work for sure, but was also helping to develop that system. So that was really my first major job out of fellowship.
What was that like?
Like career defining, transformative, fascinating. You know, Qatar was an interesting place back then. They, for many years, had flown really under the radar globally. And at some point, they decided that they really wanted to modernize as fast as they possibly could. So they have imported a ton of labor over the years and have spent billions of dollars transforming their cities into megalopolises and putting healthcare systems into place, et cetera. So I was there just as like they were really taking off and doubling down on the commitment to growth. And so it was kind of a strange place to work. I mean, on one hand, it was this multinational community of people from around the world, right? Bangladesh, Nepal, a lot of Westerner expats there, certainly a lot of Arabs, Qataris and others were there as well. And so from that perspective, a really, really fascinating place to work, but it didn't come without its own concerns. And as I write about in the book, one of the challenges was that they were so dependent on imported labor. And I would say that the safety regulations were not, I would say, world caliber. A lot of people were getting injured. Some of the laborers were being mistreated. And so I was a little bit conflicted by that because we would see every day when I went to work, these people in preventable accidents and suffering in some cases actually from cardiac channel problems that were killing them at night that was exacerbated by heat. And so I was a bit conflicted by the work. But what I did realize was that it was a bit of a complicated question because, of course, the work that was being provided in Qatar were feeding entire families and communities back in Bangladesh and Nepal. And that was really the sole source of income for some of these places. And so it was always a bit of a balancing act, sort of trying to figure out how to navigate these places and, whether there were moral concerns and how to address those moral concerns.
Were there any changes that happened, positive or negative, while you were there that you experienced?
Yeah, I think we did. I mean, I look back with some degree of pride at the system that we built there. It was one of those opportunities, I think, to have a big mark. They certainly had money, but they didn't have a lot of know-how or expertise on how to build a world-class system. So what we were able to do, I think this was really the ultimate form of knowledge transfer, if it's working well, is to take certainly our group's experience in how to do emergency medicine and EMS and come on in with new policies and protocols and to train people and to bring in best practices. And I think ultimately, after a couple of years there, we left with a system that was much higher functioning, I would say world, you know, really world-class at that point, after just a few years. They had the money and they had the vision and the passion for it. We brought the know-how. So it was a really synergistic setup.
Have you gone back since you've left?
I did. So you know, it's funny. I've spent the past couple of years back in the Middle East working there. And so not in Qatar though. So I one weekend decided to take a short trip over to Doha and take a look around. And it's really funny because I'd been gone at that point, gosh, you know, what is it, 10, 15 years. And like, I scarcely recognize the city. I mean, if you've never been to these places, I'd say China is an example of them. Certainly the Middle East is an example of them. The amount of growth, the amount of money, the amount of development that's taking place is just eye-watering. And so I knew the hotel I was living at. I went back there. I stayed there again for a couple nights, but I couldn't find my way to the hotel. All the roads were new. There was a new subway system that was in place. It was pretty disorienting.
There's something odd about it's like these wealthy authoritarian regimes that sort of have what feels like unlimited capital. And it's a mixture of like this really dark stuff. And you're talking about the labor aspect of it. And then this rapid development and progress within, you know, technology and industry. Not sure what to make of that, but
it's a funny place because, you know, I certainly have always grown up with this idea that democracy was the ultimate sort of form of governance, the most effective form of governance, one that has built over the years the great cultures of Europe and North America. And yet you go now to places like the UAE, to Qatar, to parts of Asia, you know, clearly these are authoritarian governments, but they seem to be functioning extremely well right now. In contrast, frankly, to the United States, where we're just basically paralyzed, right? Politically paralyzed, unable to build anything really notable or impressive. It's been like that for years to my mind. And so it's an interesting question, but these places are thriving.
Let's get to Africa. You know, in the book you write, the reasons for my trip to Africa were quite pragmatic. In my case, Kenya was less about escapism and more about a desire to focus. I wanted to ground myself in the essentials of medicine. I wanted to dispense with the superfluousness of administrators, their monetization of everything decent, and the unreasonable demands of the modern ER. I wanted to work intimately with patients. And tell us a bit more about that decision, about what was going on in your career that moved you to go.
You know, I hit a wall quite early, I think, in contrast to some of your listeners who've been really, you know, grinding it out for years and years. I went through this process of really pedal to the metal, committing to medicine, committing to emergency medicine, doing my training, putting my head down, doing all those sorts of things. And I was continuing to work in the academic emergency departments of Pennsylvania, where I was. And I remember one morning waking up and looking around this ER that was basically emerging from the night before, right? The place looked like a war zone. Every bed was filled. The hallways were filled. The nurses were exhausted. The doctors were exhausted. And yet the charts continued to stack up. There was like all these patients to be seen. The sign out was 35 patients. A bunch of them were boarders who were supposed to be upstairs. A couple of ICU patients that we'd be managing for hours and hours on the vent. And yet there were more charts stacked up and there were more patients in the waiting room and they were angrily demanding to be seen quite correctly. I mean, they'd been there for a long time. And I remember looking around and thinking to myself, God, this isn't really what I had imagined it was going to be. And I had this idea when I went into this business that there was going to be an opportunity to sit and spend time with patients and listen to their concerns and really to tend to them, you know, address their concerns and treat them and really emphasize that doctor-patient relationship. And what I looked around to me felt much more of sort of an industrial process, right? And kind of a broken industrial process where the only way I was going to catch that MI that was coming in to the waiting room was to churn through a bunch of charts and to create space and to move as quickly as I could and to cut corners and to cut the consultant, to call the consultants early for stuff that I could probably handle if I just had the time to do it. And I remember just being so disillusioned, right? Like this, all the stuff that we had been sold during the course of training just has turned out not to be the case after the fact. I felt a little bit taken for a ride, to be honest with you. Like this isn't what was promised on the other side. And I needed to figure out what to do next with my career. Like I knew that I wouldn't be happy spending the rest of my life seeing patients one after the other in the ER. And by the way, I say this recognizing that many of my colleagues do make that decision to do it. And I have nothing but the utmost admiration for our colleagues who are working basically in a war zone, putting their heads down and just doing what needs to be done. Emergency medicine, primary care, you name it. I mean, all these people. But I felt that I just didn't want to do that. I didn't know what was next. So it was one of these kind of lucky things that happened to me. I ended up looking around and I remember that I had a colleague, you know, from much older than I am, my parents' generation, who had spent time working for a group in Africa called the Flying Doctor Service. And these were originally back in the 1950s, a group of doctors that came together to form a small organization that would fly with Cessnas out into rural parts of East Africa and do surgical clinics and medical clinics and those sorts of things. And over the years, it had evolved into actually an air ambulance service, among other things. I mean, AMREF today is a pretty extraordinary organization that does, you know, hand washing, public health, malaria, community health worker training, I mean, all this kind of stuff. But they also have this division that's really East Africa's premier ambulance. They're the only people who can get in to the most remote airstrips and the most difficult places to medevac patients back to Nairobi. And so I sent them an email just one morning. I was in my bathrobe. I'd had a shift before. I sent them an email. I said, are you guys looking for some help? And it's one of those fortuitous things, but within 24 hours, the leader got back to me and said, yeah, you know, can you be here next month? We actually have an opening for a doctor. And so without much thought, honestly, I got my Kenyan medical license. I made the preparations to go. And, you know, within 6 weeks, I was on the ground in Kenya seeing patients.
Wow. What does it take to get your Kenyan medical license? What does that involve?
It takes like a couple bucks and an American medical license, huh. Honestly. That's all
pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I wonder how you think about this, you know, contra to like the concept of escapism. How do you say this is not escapism, but in some ways you're escaping a system that is breaking or broken? Maybe talk a little bit about that distinction for us.
I think it's there's a well-known sort of trope in Western literature of people who leave home to find themselves. And I think my journey was very much an example of that trope. What I needed to do was to create space to listen to myself. And paradoxically, sometimes listening to yourself requires you to step out of the daily quotidian and to put yourself into a completely new environment where you're not familiar, where I think your senses are sort of hyper acute. You're listening certainly to your environment because it's new, but you're also listening to yourself. And somehow there's a clarity to it. I reference in the book a lot Joseph Campbell, who's some of your listeners may be younger and haven't come across Joseph Campbell yet, but he was a writer and sort of theologian back in the 80s and 90s who wrote a lot about this concept of the hero's journey or journeys away from home, where you really have the opportunity to create the sacred space to listen to yourself and to really convince yourself that the life you're leading is the life that you ought to be leading. I think so often it's easy for us in medicine to put our heads down and just kind of keep on trucking, right? You put your head down, you commit to something, you just keep on trucking. I think sometimes you have a vague sense internally that it's not what you should be doing, but you just haven't taken the time or haven't put in the work to ask yourself what it is you should be doing instead. So it just kind of becomes a bit of an autopilot. And Joseph Campbell really urged people, I think, to take trips away, all right, to really create that space. And for me, that's what Africa was. It was truly an opportunity, I think, to really spend several months working in an unfamiliar environment and asking myself what it is I wanted to do.
Tell us a bit about this Flying Doctor service that you volunteered with. How did it get started and what services does it provide to the people of Africa? You mentioned a little bit, but maybe we can go into a bit more detail.
Fascinating. It's a really interesting organization. So AMREF used to be called the African Medical Research Foundation, Education Foundation, but now it's just called AMREF. They've actually shortened it, it's called. And it was started back in 1953 by three doctors. There was the chief surgeon of the Royal Air Force, Archie MacIndoe, who was a reconstructive surgeon, really pioneered a lot of the reconstructive techniques that are still used today for burns and serious injuries. And he had retired, but over the years had trained a bunch of people from around the world. And so a bunch of doctors got together to form this organization. There was Dr. McIndoe. There were two young trainees that he had. There was Dr. Tom Reese, who was an American surgeon, reconstructive surgeon from New York. And there was another Englishman as well. And the three of them got together to form this organization. And as I say, really started their early years flying their own Cessnas into the bush and opening tent clinics and taking care of patients, et cetera, et cetera. The American, by the way, is an interesting fellow, Dr. Tom Reese, who was originally from Utah and actually moved into New York and tried to establish himself as a plastic surgeon. And what's interesting about that was, of course, he was blackballed in the early years in New York City. There was a, you know, kind of a group there that didn't want an outsider to come in and set up a practice. But he persevered and actually got privileges and started seeing patients. And he became the go-to guy for plastic surgery in New York City. Like if you were a starlet and you needed a nose job, you went to go see Dr. Tom Reese in New York. He did that for years and years. But also over a period of 40 years, he went to Africa. He would split his time. And so he'd always, every year, set aside a couple months to go see those patients in Africa. And he called it living his bliss. This was for Tom really what grounded him and what was most important to him. And he wrote books. He wrote a book about it afterwards, which is great reading. But the organization grew steadily. I mean, originally it was these three doctors. They added a bunch of doctors. The organization got far more sophisticated. And today it's really, I think, the premier healthcare NGO in East Africa. It's exclusively healthcare and they do kind of everything really well. And the nice thing about it, or really the important thing about it, is that it's really at this point completely African-led. So what you tend to see a lot in Africa is a lot of international aid that comes in and that's misdirected. They don't really know how things work. They don't know the priorities. If you ever spend time in rural African hospitals, you'll see a lot of donated equipment that like runs on 110 voltage and the voltage there is like 220, right? The people are just those kinds of simple things. So AMREF, to my mind, is this remarkably effective group, and they're doing really well today.
So it's not only transport, but it's care in various places too. They run clinics or hospitals. Yeah.
Surgical outreach. They send sort of urologists and surgeons up to county hospitals to do outreach surgeries. They do malaria work. They do community health care worker trainings. They have actually a medical university to train allied health workers. So it's really kind of a broad and effective group. Hmm.
You took care of quite a few aid workers and expats in your time there. I wonder what motivated other people to go. Was there, I mean, maybe it, sort of in the throw of things, it's sort of hard to find out, but was there a common theme amongst people who gave up their lives to go to Africa to help? What did you notice?
I quote actually in one of my chapters, a Canadian colleague of mine, when I was in the Middle East, who said there are three reasons people become expats. They're either there for the money, which in Africa, they're not there for the money, or they're there for the adventure, or they're there to escape something. And I think, to my mind, that has actually always proven to be the case. People are, and you see this a lot actually with the English, because there's such dissatisfaction with the National Health Service that you get a ton of these doctors who go to Africa and just love it. They go to Australia, they go to Africa, they just try to get out of the UK because the NHS is a grind. But you're also there. I think there are certainly people who are idealists who are trying to change the world and to do good work. And there are a lot of people who just function better in a place like Africa. They don't like the way that healthcare is organized, the systematization of the American healthcare system, et cetera. So they seem to thrive there. But they were a quirky bunch. I have, you know, this utmost respect for people who dedicate their lives to this kind of work. You know, to be clear, I did not dedicate my life to becoming an aid worker in Africa. For me, it was a question of several tours of a couple months in Africa. And so that's really not where my life was, although it was for me a pivotal time in my career. But there are people who've spent 20, 30, 40 years working in Africa, and that's home for them, and this is the work they've committed to, and I'm just in awe of their commitment.
Tell us about your role when you went there. What was your day-to-day like?
Really fun. So I ended up setting shop in a little bungalow near the airport. There's two airports in Nairobi. There's the big international airport, and then there's a regional airport where we were based. We had a big hangar. And so I slept in a very simple bungalow, an old English, a colonial club, Aero Club, with bad English food, but it was nearby. You go to Africa to eat bangers and mash and fish and chips. It was kind of bizarre, but it was what it was. And every morning I would take my bike down to the hangar at the airport, and we would typically fly daily. I was on call every day, unless we were just so ground out from flights and needed a break, and they would call in one of the African doctors to fill in as well. But I was typically on call for the whole duration of time that I was there. And we would usually get a call in the morning. Usually in Africa, you can't land at nighttime. There aren't a lot of lit airstrips. And so things go quiet at night and they pick up at first light. So often we would make it to the hangar. There would be an emergency repatriation flight from somewhere. Our operations folks would brief us. They had a strong focus on sort of operations and safety. And then we would leave. And over the course of my travels there, we went to 11 African countries. We plucked out patients from small airstrips across Africa. Some bigger cities, we would fly a small jet. Smaller cities, we would fly a bush plane, a Cessna, to get up there. And you never knew what you were going to get. The patients, everything from bad traumas to a lot of tropical disease, just a lot of cardiac disease. It was interesting because Africa was, of course, it's becoming more affluent over time. And so the types of illnesses and injuries that you saw changed. A lot more trauma, a lot more cardiac disease, a lot more diseases of affluence. And so a day could be managing a patient with severe DKA, bringing them back to Nairobi. There could be a lot of serious traumas. On my second tour in 2012, it was a lot different from 2008 in the sense that there had actually been a lot of insurrection that had broken out, coming out of Somalia. There was a civil war in Somalia. There was a lot of terrorism that had bled into Kenya. And the African Union was in Somalia trying to maintain the peace, and we were oftentimes flying into Somalia to try to pick up African Union soldiers who'd been badly injured. So there was also a lot of bullet wounds and shrapnel and war injuries that we had to manage and stabilize and bring back. Hmm.
So treat them in the field, fly them to a hospital in Nairobi?
Yeah, exactly. So we flew with a full suite of ICU level care, right? Ventilators, drips. We could do chest tubes, central lines. We could give blood. I mean, all those sorts of things. Advanced stabilization in the field. Obviously, we couldn't do surgery in the field, but we would treat and stabilize everything from DKA to severe malaria, intubate children, put in chest tubes, those sorts of things.
There's a patient you end up rescuing whose diagnosis is unknown. And there's some concern that he may have a viral disease that could be highly contagious and deadly. And you wrestle with this question about whether to transport him to another hospital because you could be spreading this disease and ultimately hurting a far larger number of people. Take us through that incident. How did you think about this? How should doctors in general think about this?
This is one of the interesting kind of moral discussions or public health versus medicine confrontations that we had to address in Africa. The story, you're exactly right. We flew to Ethiopia to pick up a guy who had presented to the outside hospital. Nobody quite knew what he had, but it seemed infectious. And they knew he was getting sicker over time and brought him to the airstrip, and we were supposed to take him to Nairobi. When they showed up, we had a stack of papers from the outside hospital. And what I could see from the lab work was that it was multi-system failure, right? Everything was shutting down. Kidneys weren't working, liver wasn't working, blood wasn't coagulating properly. Super, super sick guy, hypotensive. But as I took a look at the guy, as we started preparing him for transport, I looked at my nurse and I said, God, this guy is really, he's like oozing blood from his eyes. His gums are bleeding. The guy is really coagulopathic. And I looked at my nurse and I said, is it possible that this is in fact the hemorrhagic virus? I've never seen one, but I've read about them. And it wouldn't be the first time that a patient with hemorrhagic virus had presented to an air ambulance. There had only a couple of years earlier been a case in South Africa of a patient with a novel hemorrhagic virus that in fact got onto an air ambulance and was brought to South Africa and ended up infecting a bunch of people and killing nurses and killing paramedics. And it wasn't a theoretical risk. It was a very real risk in Africa. As you know, these things kind of pop up every so often. And so I looked at my nurse and I said, I'm not really sure what to do here because we've got this patient in front of us. He's my patient now. I've been taking care of him for the past 10 or 15 minutes. He's mine. And yet there is this risk, of course, that if we take a patient with a highly infectious virus like Ebola to Nairobi, we run the risk of infecting dozens or hundreds or thousands of people in Nairobi. And I realized at the time that I actually just didn't have the right framework for handling this question because, of course, we all trained in medicine and the Hippocratic Oath was sacred to us. And not abandoning your patient is a moral prerogative, a moral imperative. But there's really nothing in the Hippocratic Oath that allows you to abandon a patient in the name of some more abstract concept of public health. It just doesn't exist. And yet, infecting thousands of people with a virus in the name of saving one life also didn't seem like the right trade-off either. And so we were very much stuck. And what was interesting was that the person who really helped me make the decision was the nurse I was working with, who had years of experience in Africa, who basically said, I just want you to know that in the emergency department where I work on the weekends, we see these sorts of patients all the time. Like this is not an uncommon presentation for a range of different infections. And so do what you will, but I just want you to be aware that like, this is not completely novel to me. And so I realized, of course, that my risk tolerance and his risk tolerance were completely different things. And that there was a very, very low risk that this was an infectious virus because, of course, there had been no announced outbreak of viral hemorrhagic fever elsewhere. And the guy was still alive after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, which wasn't consistent. And so we took the risk. We put on our masks and our gowns and we, you know, hoped that we didn't have anything serious that we were exposed to. And we flew the guy to Nairobi and he actually didn't turn out. He had a bacterial infection, a severe bacterial infection, but it wasn't hemorrhagic virus. Hmm.
You write about emergency medicine that it is about beginnings and it's only infrequently about endings. And that's something that I noticed about emergency medicine when I was in medical school. And the job often seems temporary in the sense that you stabilize patients, transfer them to other units in the hospital. And this theme seemed to hold true for you in Africa. And you describe how you were evacuating patients from one awful hospital to another, maybe better hospital, providing them with American standard care in the air and then bringing them somewhere else. So a couple of questions on this. How do you learn with unknown endings?
As I say in the book, the challenge with the emergency medicine is that you very rarely get feedback unless you've been wrong. In which case, your internist friends call you up right away and say, hey, like the worst thing you want to hear when you show up on a shift is, do you remember that patient? Because nobody ever says, do you remember that patient with? You made a great diagnosis of an esoteric illness. Congratulations. Nobody ever says that. They always say, hey, do you remember that patient with? It turns out he didn't have. And that's always really tough. I mean, I think, medicine diseases take time to sort of play out and to declare themselves. And I think that's an expected part of medicine. But you've got to be clear with the ambiguity. I really encouraged when I was an attending doctor, my trainees to actually spend half an hour a shift going back when they finished up and checking the notes of patients that they saw a couple of days or a couple of weeks earlier. To me, that was such a valuable learning opportunity and so key. But you better feel comfortable with ambiguity, right? And I think it's oftentimes easy to criticize emergency medicine because you have the benefit of a retrospectoscope, right, when you're on the floor. And it's hard at the time. But as I also say, the nice thing about it is there's very few decisions you make in emergency medicine that are not reversible. If you make a mistake, somebody will catch it and augment the therapy or change the therapy, and that's okay as well. That's just an expected thing.
And there's the age-old question about medical mission work. You know, is there something long-lasting here, or is it a short stint? And I think about this, I thought about this while I was reading the book, you know, comparing your experience in Qatar to these stints in Africa. And maybe you can talk a bit about that and how you kind of compare the two.
What I really liked about AMREF is that the organization actually doesn't depend on foreigners to come in and provide care. I mean, they've got best nurses in East Africa work for AMREF. They pay really well. They've got a team of local anesthesiologists and doctors who staff the ambulances as well. So they really look to outsiders, to international workers to come in and really serve as a source of best practice transfer. So you're there staffing ambulances. They expected us to give a couple lectures while we were there of state-of-the-art practice, which we did. And they had the benefit, I think, of getting people from the UK and Australia and America and Canada. And they all kind of came in and brought different types of practice there. and the Africans could pick and choose what they thought was what they wanted to emulate. And so, to my mind, that was a really good example of information transfer. It was working the way it should. I think in Qatar as well, we were there to train. We were there to bring best practice in. There was, of course, a bidirectional. These things are always, if you're doing it right, kind of a bidirectional experience where I'm bringing in what I know, and I'm certainly learning a lot from my colleagues in terms of interesting presentations of illness and tropical disease and really expanding my repertoire. So that was very valuable. As I noticed in the book, though, I'm a little skeptical, honestly, of a lot of this international work. It feels like poverty porn in some cases. And I describe a couple examples of people coming in to go to villages and like build an outhouse for a weekend and proselytize a little bit and clap their hands and feel good about themselves and leave. And the honest answer is like, they don't need you to come from Wichita to build an outhouse. That's not a good use of money. But I also don't want to be too hoity-toity about this. I mean, the truth is that I think it is valuable for people from the United States to go to poor countries and to look around and to realize that the world is a complicated place and that there are people living completely different lives from the ones that we appreciate at home. And if you can take a little bit of that knowledge and sentiments back to where you came from and really recalibrate the way you approach the world, I think that's valuable in itself. So I don't want to get too snooty about it, but the concerns you raise are valid, of course.
Was there a particular patient encounter or event that you think really was the most impactful for you there?
Yeah, there's one that really stands out to me. So the book's 22. The book is a story of 22 missions to those 11 countries in East Africa. They were sort of the most interesting of the 22 stories that I wrote about. And there's one that I wrote was picking up a little boy from northern Kenya. He had been hit by a car. He was like really, really rural area. I think he had never been in a car. His parents had been in cars a couple times. They had certainly never been in an airplane before. But as the story went, there was this little boy playing in the village and he was struck by a vehicle and was severely injured. And the only surgeon in that county of Kenya was unavailable. He was at a conference. So he had something clearly intra-abdominal process taking place. He needed a surgeon. And so we did a charity flight up to northern Kenya to pick this kid up. And came in on a Cessna caravan and landed on a dirt strip and met the parents and the baby there. They were Muslim. The woman was veiled. They didn't speak Swahili. They didn't speak English. They spoke their regional dialect. So we had so few things that were in common. We met the kids that came, met the kid that came on an ambulance. The parents looked at me as I entered the ambulance. And there was something universal about that experience in the sense that they fully understood the doctor-patient relationship, as did I. They had this implicit trust that I would take care of their little boy. And though we spoke no language in common, we had no background in common, no religion in common, no shared experiences, completely different socioeconomic backgrounds, this woman looked at me and she handed her most precious possession to me, her little boy, and trusted that I would care for him. There was this like really, really profound experience. We couldn't share a single word in common. There was no translation, but we ended up getting on the Cessna and we flew into Nairobi, their first flight ever. And I remember feeling this strong sense of sort of paternalistic concern for both of these young parents and for their boy, who ended up having surgery and actually did fine on the other side. But it struck me as really the essence of what I had hoped to do as a doctor. It was exactly this kind of culmination of all of those years of training, doing precisely what I had decided to do or was the vision for what I wanted to do when I was younger. Hmm.
Has this changed the way that you practice medicine now or the way you approach your career or think about your career now?
Yeah. So I made some key decisions when I was in Africa. The first decision was that I really wanted to try to fix the US healthcare system when I went back home. I knew it was so incredibly dysfunctional. And what I realized, of course, was that emergency medicine looks the way it does because it basically is where all of the dysfunction in US healthcare ends up. Whether you have a problem with not enough skilled nursing beds, whether you have a problem with not enough inpatient beds, whether you don't have enough specialists, whatever your issue is, the only place in the system that doesn't have a door is the emergency department. So what you're seeing there is the culmination of years of mismanagement across the healthcare system. So I wanted to go back and fix the system, and I was trying to decide the best way to do that. And I realized that it wouldn't be seeing patients in the emergency department exclusively. What I wanted to do was to try to get upstream a little bit to where a lot of the dysfunction was born, which to my mind was the way that we pay for healthcare. Because I think, having done this for a number of years, what ends up happening is that we pay for the wrong things in medicine. We incentivize the wrong behaviors. We have too many people at the trough getting fat across the spectrum of healthcare, whether it's medical device manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies. And so the funds flow ultimately determines the dysfunction in the system. And yet there's a reliance on the doctors and nurses to continue to do the right thing. And that's really what keeps the entire system afloat. It's just basically the commitment of the doctors and the nurses to doing the right thing that keeps the whole thing working. And so I wanted to gain the skills to go and try to fix the system. And I did. I went back and got a management degree and learned finance and learned operations and learned management, because I think without those skills, doctors are a bit powerless to deal with spreadsheets, to deal with these questions of how medicine is organized. And then it was a decision about how to work, which parts of the system to work in. I think if you're trying to disrupt the system, there's a couple ways to do it. You either try to do it from within the system, or you try to work for new entrants who are trying to create better models of care, and you support them and build them. And I chose to do the latter. I decided to really only work for organizations that were paid for in a different way from fee-for-service, value-based payment models that I think really unleash a lot of ingenuity and creativity. And I've worked really for the past 10, 15 years for exclusively those types of organizations that give us the space to create different models of care delivery. And so that was the commitment I made in Africa, and that's what my life has looked like since.
Because you saw in some ways the purity of what you were doing in Africa, this kind of medicine distilled to its essence, and you wanted to bring that in some respect to the United States. The only way to do that was through reform.
I knew how good medicine could be when it was practiced with the right motives and given the right parameters. And, you know, that experience with that little boy in Africa was exactly what doctor-patient relationships should look like. The kind of care that I could deliver over a period of several hours, tending to the parents, tending to their child, was exactly what I was there to do. It was all those years of training and medical school and residency. It's exactly what I wanted to do, and yet it didn't exist at home. Unless you really worked hard to carve out that space, but yet in the back of your mind, there were always 50 other people who needed to be squeezed in as well. It was never that. And what a privilege to be able to sort of clear your mind, right? Clear your mind of the other 50 patients and the other 500 things you needed to do, and the prior authorizations and the paperwork and the insurance calls. Just focus on a patient and like administer to them. That to me was so valuable that I really wanted to figure out if we could create the conditions to be able to do that back at home. And so I ended up actually working for, as I say, value-based physician groups that created that space for doctors to be able to do that. And also particularly for a couple of years with very innovative primary care delivery groups that really decompressed the primary care visit, gave clinicians much more time to see patients and to do the right thing for them, even if it wasn't, you know, standard fee-for-service DRG type care, that you created space to deliver these alternative models. And that was just such a valuable experience to be able to create that space for doctors.
Are you more hopeful now about the American healthcare system or less?
I am inherently a hopeful guy, although we are living in dark times. I think frankly the system has become so bad that there's only one way, which is better. I mean, this can't go on, right? I think the degree of greed in the American healthcare system today is so acute. That it's threatening to fall in on itself, right? And at the same time, we've been so let down by the large organizations, the people in organizations that should be doing the right thing, all the way, frankly, from CDC, which to my mind has become incredibly politicized, through insurance companies that really, to my mind, exist for the sake of feeding the shareholders, to large healthcare systems that function like large oligopolies. None of it's designed with the clinician or the patient in mind, right? And this can't go on. This just can't go on. So I'm hopeful with there's been so much innovation in the startup space over the past couple of years. And I see these really interesting models of care that have emerged that just delivers such a better product. So I look at examples of companies like ChenMed, that's, senior care under Medicare Advantage. Iora Health, where I was the chief medical officer, was an example of just spectacular care that was delivered to seniors. I see it in sort of retail care delivery space, which I know people poo-poo, but frankly, it increases access for people with low acuity conditions and does it fairly consistently and well. And so I'm seeing this sort of shoots, these tendrils popping up that to me are really kind of signs that the system is sensing the strain and wants to do better.
One last question about Africa. Multiple instances in the book, you mention religion, and in particular, Catholicism and the Catholic hospitals within Africa. And it seemed to me that when no hospital in Africa would take a patient, the Catholic charity hospitals did. How do you see the role of these hospitals on the continent?
The religion, if you know, in the book, I struggle with religion. I think what you're reading is a book written by a bit of a religious skeptic, honestly, who entered Africa prepared, I think, on some level to take a very critical stance on particularly religious medical organizations, right? I was a bit skeptical of the proselytizers, a bit skeptical of the people who showed up, you know, converting people. The whole thing just felt a bit icky to me. It wasn't my bag. But as I was there, I realized that I developed a far more nuanced sense of religion in Africa. And I think there were two examples in the book that really stand out. The first was a visit to evacuate a patient with cerebral malaria from a small Catholic hospital called St. Mary's in Uganda. And the hospital was remarkable. It was several doctors who worked there, an Italian doctor and a Canadian doctor, who were strict Catholics who believed firmly in their mission, dedicated their entire lives to caring for people there. It was a hospital that served as shelter for people who were fleeing the Lord's Resistance Army, which was this brutal, brutal organization in Uganda. And they sheltered for years on end children at nighttime within the gates of the hospital. And so if you add up the amount of good work that these people have done over the past 20 or 30 or 50 years, it's remarkable, right? This really high functioning organization. There was another example when we flew into Goma to rescue a priest, actually. And it was a sort of an interesting story. The Bishop of Goma showed up on the runway, and we were prepared to be shaken down by the runway workers, which was pretty common to be shaken down for money. And the bishop showed up and nobody made a peep. Like, there was absolute respect for this guy who showed up. And it's interesting when you actually take a look at the history of the DRC that this is a group of people for whom government has failed again and again and again. And really the institutions that work in that place, whether it's schools or whether it's hospitals or whether it's clinics, they're religiously sponsored. They're sponsored by the Catholic hospitals and to some extent by the Protestants as well, who were there running these things. And people became extremely appreciative and dependent on these organizations. And so, you know, I think it was an important lesson for me to not come in with these sort of preconceived notions about or cynical perspectives on what the church can and can't do. Here are two examples of remarkable work that was done for the right reasons, and I had great respect for what I saw.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was really interesting. And the organization is called AMREF. I assume there's a way for people to donate to it if they
so choose. So there's a local office in New York that's, you can do a tax deductible donation. Also one in Canada and across Europe, they have offices as well. So great organization.
Great. And the book is called Urgent Calls from Distant Places. Thanks again for taking the time.
Thanks, Aaron.
This podcast has been produced by the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Visit eppc.org to learn more about our programs, events, and podcasts.